Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Frankly, one of the problems that young conservatives have right now is that there are not a lot of issues that people are like, I care, you know, I'm a young person who cares a lot about this issue, and that's why I'm a Republican. The Democrats actually do have a lot of issues where it's like you said earlier, if you're a young person who cares a lot about climate, you're a Democrat. If you're a young person who cares a lot about racial injustice, you're a Democrat. If you're a young person who cares a lot about LGBTQ rights, you're very likely to be a Democrat. One of the only issues that Republicans have working in their favor is this issue of free speech and, you know, what some people call cancel culture, which I agree with, or I forgot who alluded to this earlier, but, you know, in talking about, again, a realignment of our politics, I think that that is an issue that's emerging.
Thanks for joining in, everyone, especially those of you who tuned in for the episode I did solo. That was a lot of fun, but I am so pumped to have Sagar back with me for a conversation that is going to resonate with everyone, old realigners and new breakers. Sagar, I'm not quite sure what the name for people who watch Breaking Points is. So we're here with Charlotte Alter. She is a senior correspondent at Time Magazine, and she's written a book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. The book is so interesting because it is recently out in paperback. The hardcover came out last year, and it takes a different approach to the questions of how millennials change politics than most of the other books or conversations you're going to feature. It isn't a conversation about millennials all have student debt. Therefore, in 2040, we are going to abolish student debt. Millennials all love climate change, therefore that's why we need to support the Green New Deal. Instead, the book is actually a profile of the first millennials to come into office after 2015. So everyone from AOC to Elise Stefanik to Carlos Corbera to Will Hurd. Some politicians in this cohort are successful. Elise Stefanik is now the third highest ranking Republican. Carlos Corbera is no longer in Congress. You have folks like Madison Cawthorn who are, I would say, elected but aren't quite exactly leading the charge when it comes to good faith public policy. So this is a book that focuses on those people. So we wanted to have a conversation with Charlotte specifically around what is it like to be a politician who is a millennial in this country right now? What lessons can we learn from the struggles and triumphs of our generation in both cohorts? And also, to be fair to the boomers, Gen Zers, and Xers here too, what we all could think about how the country is going to change under millennial leadership.
Yeah, I had a really great time talking with Charlotte here because she took some of our pushback really well. It's clearly, I think she's pretty ideologically liberal, and that's okay. What she came through is an appreciation for what the future battle lines of tomorrow are going to be and how exactly people in current politics will say, see, these millennials, they're so liberal. Like, they all believe in abolishing student debt. And as I point out in the episode, well, there's two ways to do that. One is to destroy the universities, abolish student debt. The other is to just have the government pay for it, and not recognizing the university system may in fact be complicit or whatever. So where you fall on that side is actually going to be the future fights of tomorrow. And understanding the cultural element to this millennial base of politics is really important for realizing that our problems are not over, folks. In terms of the fights, they really are just beginning. They're just going to happen in a totally different context. So all of that being said, we had an awesome conversation. I want to make sure, especially for the people who are new here, check out the Realignment Substack, which you'll get weekly, has a roundup of everything that we're talking about, what's going on in our lives, book lists, etc. The Realignment Bookshop, you can buy both Charlotte's book or any book that you want by following that link, as well as a bunch of recommendations that both of us have given over the last several months. It's a great way to help an independent bookstore during COVID-19 and the show.
And something I want to raise, yesterday I had an awesome episode of The Deep End, my podcast at On Deck, where I brought Sagar on to talk with him about launching Breaking Points. To quote Sagar from the episode, this is business Sagar. So if you're looking for a differentiation, if you're looking for a differentiated interview, it's really fascinating because biases as a co-host aside, I think Sagar has been really brilliant around this whole process. And there is so much to learn from the way that he and Crystal have approached this as a business venture, as an idea, as a media industry that's changing, and just not looking at it through a political lens. You can get that a lot of different places, but we really focus here on why did you choose to charge what you charge? What is it like to leave a media company? How terrible is it to set up a company online? Yeah. This will be the most boomer libertarian you ever see Sagar. His small business, it's very difficult, and I'm sure he's taxed very much.
It's true. I'm a small business owner now, okay? I understand it. I understand my brethren and the things that they've been complaining about. It was fun. I never really get to talk about this side of it. If you're thinking about leaving a media company, think twice, because it's really, really hard. Now, it worked out for Crystal and I, but take a listen because it's important that you try and at least understand a lot of the logistics that you're going to have to overcome.
And it is linked in the show notes here and will be featured in this week's newsletter, so be sure to sign up for that.
All that being said, let's get to the question answer period.
We are to the Q&A section. So what we do every single episode is we take a question from the audience that has been sent into us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or left on Apple Podcasts with a 5-star review. This is, of course, us asking for you all to give us some ratings. There's a lot of you listeners, so we would love for you to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. But let's get to today's actual question. It is from Apple Podcasts, ATM830. Quality Intellectual Programming is the title. The Realignment is a fantastic program that explores important, often overlooked questions about America's cultural, political, and economic future. Guests are great. Hosts are even better. Body, blah. Thank you for that really nice statement. I appreciate it, but we don't have to read the whole thing out loud. My question for both hosts. With nearly every facet of life being ported to the digital ecosystem, I question whether young adults and kids have the ability to healthily adapt to technologies they're born into. Specifically due to companies' investment and reliance on psychological, emotional, and attention manipulating tactics. Do you think politicians should address this through educational legislation, similar to how young people must get a driver's license, that give kids the pros, cons, opportunities, and pitfalls of the technology they're using? What do you think, Sagar?
I don't know if we're there yet necessarily. I think a lot of it has to do with parents. And actually thinking about it in a school education context is probably the most useful, which is that people should be aware about blue light, about the way algorithms work, about the way games and all these things. These are just basic, I think, educational how to adapt to society type curricula, which wouldn't be that hard, in my opinion, in order to implement all across the country, and also wouldn't require any sort of like mandatory level stuff. It's just you could leave it for communities in order to think about the specific problems up to them, but also have it so that they could consider how and what they want to teach their kids. What do you think?
Yeah, this is probably a space where I'm a little more libertarian, despite everything we say on the podcast. I'm pretty confident that there are these really short-term harms that come when any new innovation or technology comes in. What largely happens is society finds ways to correct for those things, and that doesn't require government to mandate a license or something. So a good example of this is, you know what, at my dinner table, when I have kids, there aren't going to be smartphones at that table. Mm-hmm. When I'm at the airport and my kid is crying or whining, I'm definitely jinxing myself. I'm not just going to give them an iPad to stare at for 8 hours, because I just know, and I think a lot of people know, that it's not a good thing. You can't just simply babysit children with blue screens. Now, that being said, I can also acknowledge that I'm really privileged to be in the position where I don't have to worry about those things, where I don't have to have the real choice of, you know, I'm able to work from home, so I'm going to be able to be with my kid a lot of the time. I'm not going to have to say, hey, farm out the child raising to the television. So I definitely think that while I'm libertarian, we should be concerned about how people who don't have economic resources aren't going to have the same ability to navigate these technologies and the negative consequences. So that's what I always think about.
That's right. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Let's get to it.
Charlotte Alter, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to see you, Charlotte.
It's good to see you too.
So we want to discuss two specific things you've written that tie together the broader story about millennial and politics that we're thinking about. So the first part is you wrote a book last year. It is now out in paperback. It's titled The Ones You've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And helpfully, your publisher on the website specifically describes it as an optimistic look at the future of American leadership. And we'll be getting into whether or not you're still optimistic given recent events. But tying to that, the second piece is an op-ed you wrote in the New York Times, which was titled How GOP Leaders Sold Out Their Generation, specifically referring to GOP leaders that you profiled in the book. So just starting here, it's hard to look at the book, the publisher's blurb, but then the recent op-ed and conclude that you're still optimistic about our generation's impact on the political system. So just starting here, what was your, and maybe it hasn't changed, so you can correct us if I'm incorrect about this, but what was your original thesis specifically about millennial leaders in politics?
So, you know, it's a good question because I think in some ways I am still optimistic, and in other ways, events of the last year have shifted a couple things. But the original thesis was really simple, that it was that our government is run by old people, but it won't be for long, and that there is a new generation that is rising to change our political system in its image. And what my book really tried to do was to identify and interview as many of those rising millennial leaders as I could on both sides of the aisle to try to figure out what drives them, what they want out of their government, what their priorities are, and importantly, why. And so one of the things that I learned in reporting this book is that most people, again, you know, this is no generational arguments should ever be taken as ironclad rules, but in general, people tend to form their political identities in reaction to the events of their early adulthood. So what I did in the book was that I tried to look at the events of early adulthood for millennials. So that's people born between 1980 and 1997, give or take 1 year, 6 months. You know, you can always say, oh, somebody was born in, like some people say it's 1981. I said 1980. Anyway, so I tried to look at the events of early adulthood for people that age and, you know, combined with interviews and data, paint a picture of why this generation cares so much about climate change, why this generation cares so much about college affordability, why universal healthcare has emerged as a major priority for young Democrats, not necessarily young Republicans right now. Why this generation seems to have a slightly different attitude towards foreign interference, towards American interference in foreign affairs. And so that was the thesis of the book, to that, you know, people form their identities in early adulthoods. What happened to millennials when they were young will inform how this rising generation governs when it does, which will happen because our government is so, so, so old.
So I think it's funny to when you put it that way. I actually something I lament a lot. And so when I'm thinking about it then in the context of the op-ed, it's been a year in between the op-ed and the book. So would you say that you still remain optimistic? Like, what about the events of the last year have either affected your optimism, pessimism? Why did you decide to write the op-ed in the first place? And maybe just give people some background as to what exactly you were trying to convey in the piece.
So in some ways, the op-ed was about a very specific corner of millennial leadership, which is millennial Republicans, which, you know, as I lay out in the book, again, it's wrong to say that all millennials are socialist Democrats, but it's also wrong to say that this generation is evenly divided 50-50 between liberals and conservatives, because it's not. This millennials lean towards Democrats by roughly like 65-35, give or take. That's a very solid, static number. In almost all polls and also in almost all like election outcomes, people who are under the age of 40 right now are leaning towards Democrats in a way that is like undeniable and also, frankly, a sort of a historical anomaly. It used to be that people voted mostly like their parents. That started to change in the years after George W. Bush, and it really accelerated under Barack Obama, and then accelerated even further under Donald Trump. So, you know, one of the things I try to parse out in the book is that young Republicans are a very important part of this generational story, but they're not half the story. They're roughly like a third of the story. And so what the op-ed was about was really about this evolution of young Republicans. Because when I first started interviewing many of these young Republicans for the book back in 2018, 2019, there were some, you know, obviously there are real ideological differences. I'm not one of those people out here arguing that young Republicans are secretly Democrats. They're not, they're Republicans, they're conservative. They share the interests and ideas and priorities of the larger conservative movement. But there were some areas where there you could really see a generational shift and a division between older Republicans and younger Republicans. And that's really where it gets interesting. It's not...
Tease that out a little bit. Like what areas? Yeah.
So, okay. So first of all, climate change. Younger Republicans were and still are, you know, significantly... less likely to believe that climate change is a hoax. You know, you don't really meet anybody under 40 who's like, climate change is fake. They might disagree on what the solutions are, but they agree that climate change is happening and that it's a problem. Race, frankly, is an issue where young Republicans still are not as racially conscious as young Democrats are, or even older Democrats are, but they tend to be more likely than older Republicans to acknowledge the ways in which our society contains racial unfairnesses. They tend to acknowledge that Black people and white people often do not have the same experience when they're pulled over by a cop. That doesn't mean they want to defund the police, but they are more aware of those social realities. Immigration is another place where younger Republicans, when I was interviewing them for my book, were more likely to support a path to citizenship, particularly for younger immigrants. And they just in general were sort of a little bit more moderate on some of these social issues that older Republicans were sort of not moving very much on. And the way to think about it, again, because it's very important to note, like that doesn't mean that they're Democrats. It doesn't mean that they're progressive. It just means that they agreed on what the problems were, but they still disagreed on what the solutions are. You know, so just because younger Republicans were more likely to acknowledge that some form of systemic racism exists in this country doesn't mean that they're like Black Lives Matter activists. You know, just because they acknowledge that climate change is real doesn't mean that they support a Green New Deal. So the sense that I got in reporting my book was that many of these younger Republicans, and again, not all, because even in my book, there are some sort of young Trumpy people who are like the Dan Crenshaws of the world, who very much were clinging to that sort of like culture warrior lane, but that there was this cohort of young Republicans starting in around 2014, 2015 through 2016 that recognized that the Republican Party was losing young people by these historic margins and were interested in finding ways that they could speak to the issues that they knew young people cared about, that they could offer conservative solutions to these problems that were basically universally acknowledged in this generation. And what my op-ed is about is really about how these young Republicans stopped doing that, you know, how they got caught up in Trumpism. And frankly, most of the people that I spoke to who had been really sort of pushing the need to modernize the Republican Party to appeal to a new generation, most of them didn't really survive the Trump presidency. They either lost their seats, or they resigned, or they retired, or they just decided, you know what, I'm not, this isn't for me anymore. Or if they're at least Stefanic, they survived and thrived, but only by transforming into a MAGA warrior.
This is what's so interesting, though, because I'm curious if you could remove policy from a second and just think about the political talent and skill set of the people you're talking about. Because Elise Stefanik is the perfect. There's so many contradictions here. Because, for example, if you actually look at her policy positions, she is pretty outspokenly moderate on issues, LGBTQ issues,
Paris climate
change. Yeah. Trump, in separate from trans people in the military, Trump is moderate on gay rights issues. So there's this mix of social issues there that mix there. But at the same time, someone like Elise Stefanik is going very aggressively MAGA when it comes to impeachment, when it comes to the election. But she's still far less conservative than Liz Cheney, for example. So to me, that suggests to a certain degree she has talent as a politician when it comes to understanding how to actually navigate the space that she's in. I don't see how you could look at the past 5 years and conclude there actually really was that much demand for conservative solutions, in the sense that the people who ran under that lane in 2015, 2016 during the Republican presidential primary, they lost. You know, Marco Rubio, we've had him on this podcast. He's at 1% in certain polls. And his whole thing in 2016 was conservative solutions. So how do you just think about how a politician has to balance what's a narrative that makes sense? How do I want to be perceived? But if, like, how do I actually get elected to office?
I think it's a great question. And you're totally right that traditional conservatism, as it was once defined, is basically dead. And that it's been replaced with a sort of a cultural movement, frankly, that is often animated by white grievance, that's often animated by fear of social change in the way that it's being pushed by the left. And, you know, one of the most dominant cultural trends that I saw among young Republicans was not even necessarily pro-Trumpism. It was anti-Trumpism, which manifests as Trumpism. You know, like, it's sort of a distinction without a difference. But I would hear all the time, you know, particularly from people like Dan Crenshaw, but now you also hear it from people like Elise Stefanik, you know, well, I don't agree with Trump on this, but the Democrats are the worst and they're railroading him. And, you know, this investigation is bull and, you know, like, they wanted to fund the police and blah, you know. And so it was like, no matter what outrageous thing Trump did, the real enemy was always the people who were trying to hold Trump accountable. And so that was this very tricky sort of like two-step where people for a while were trying to sort of like not fully embrace Trump, but be enough on his team that they could benefit from his immense popularity. And, you know, I think this is one of the things that is tricky about this moment, is that part of what I saw in my book, and again, I don't want to overstate it, I only saw glimmers of this. You know, it was not like there was this robust millennial conservative movement led by Elise Stefanik and Carlos Curbelo that was like really strong and like gonna take over the party. They were at the very beginning of trying to grow those seeds, you know? So they were like early. I mean, they were in the first, I mean, the GOP autopsy that concluded that Republicans needed to do better with young people, that came out in 2013. So we're talking about 2 or 3 years of some younger Republicans, not even the Republican Party as a whole, because Elise Stefanik actually had kind of a hard time getting some Republican leadership on board with her, you know, plans to try to recruit more women to run for office. So this wasn't even something that the Republican Party was united on. It was just that there were some young Republicans who were at the very early stages of being like, listen, we know we're losing young people. How can we change, moderate, offer some kind of olive branch to this generation? And it was such a fledgling movement that you know, that it was very easy for Trumpism to just kind of like plow right over it. Like it had never had anything close to the strength of the young progressive movement right now. Like,
sure. Well, see, that's the interesting question, though. What is the strength of the young progressive movement? I mean, these people can't even win a primary in New York City, the most liberal place in the entire country. I mean, they eat themselves alive by unendorsing candidates or whatever all the time. They haven't forced any votes for the Biden presidency. From what I can tell, they're basically completely irrelevant with the Democrats holding all three branches of government. And this isn't just me saying this. My other co-host, Crystal Ball, an actual progressive, is the one who is saying this. So, yeah, like millennials may not want Trump, but I don't think they want AOC either, at least from what I can gather. I'm just curious for like the whole, because I see this all the time. People are like, well, you know, millennials support gay marriage. And I'm like, okay, like gay marriage is not a fight, even remotely relevant fight in American politics anymore, like whatsoever. Around public safety, like, yes, maybe millennials will more marginally support like defund the police from like 27% to 13%. That doesn't mean that 67 or whatever percent still don't want it. So try to define it along, this whole podcast is called The Realignment. Like,
yeah.
Try to define it more along those terms of, yeah, like, you know, Elise Stefanik and Dan Crenshaw, in my opinion, just pioneered social liberalism with economic conservatism, which is a basic constituency of zero. And now people are saying like, oh, well, you know, they're not fulfilling that mandate. I don't think there really was one in the first place. Talk about what the actual mandate for a millennial type politician actually would look like in American politics.
So I think that's, I think you're making a really important point. And listen, you're totally right. In one of the youngest and most progressive cities in the world, you're absolutely correct that progressives, you know, burned their own boat with Diane Morales. And the sort of youth wave that was supposed to propel Bernie Sanders to the Democratic nomination didn't really materialize, or it was splintered among some of these other candidates, which is why I'm always, you know, like I have a whole chapter in the book about like millennial socialism and sort of like what it is and also what it isn't, because it is a small but growing movement, and it's still incredibly small. I mean, mm-hmm. You can fit every member of the Democratic Socialists of America inside Fenway Park. Like that is not a dominant American political movement. So you're right that their electorate, and frankly, one of the things that I think a lot of people in the press get wrong about this is that progressives do often insist that they have more electoral power than they do. And I think they're wrong. I think that they should acknowledge the fact that, you know, really most of the Democratic Party is probably closer to Joe Biden than to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
But where they're right is that they actually do have a lot of rhetorical power, and they have a lot of power in shaping the conversation and in changing the parameters of debate.
Absolutely.
So, for example, we would not, you know, the fact that Medicare for All was like such a major issue in the Democratic primary that there were three debates that were like all about Medicare for All. And honestly, it was getting, frankly, really boring after a while, because it was just like, how many times can you go
around? How are you going to pay for it?
I know, like, it's like, how many times can you go around and around on the same issue? But like the fact that that was such a central question in that primary, when, 5-6 years earlier, you know, Democrats had just passed the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, not really had as much of a robust conversation about universal healthcare. Like, that's because of this young progressive movement that is sort of demanding, as you said, a realignment of how government intersects with the economy, and a realignment of government responsibility for economic justice. So I would say that you're absolutely right that millennial progressives are often kind of like beating a dead horse when it comes to their electoral prospects. But the fact that defunding the police is even like one end of this conversation around how to deal with just policing in America. Like, again, it is very likely not going to happen. It's probably not even going to happen in New York City, which is one of the most progressive cities in the country.
But I mean, it looks like they're about to elect a cop as mayor. So like,
right. But part of what I'm arguing in this book is that we have to take a longer view than just this next election or the next mayoral election or the next presidential election. We have to acknowledge that the population of this country is changing, because the people who were once the sort of like college students, you know, excited to vote for Barack Obama, are now in their like late 30s and 40s. And many of the people who were in their 60s and 70s in the 2008 election are no longer with us. So, so people, again, one of the main points I'm making is that people often form their political opinions when they're young in reaction to the events of early adulthood, and then they largely carry them with them as they age. That's not to say nobody ever changes their mind about anything. Obviously, there are new facts, there are wars, there are people get new jobs, people have kids, like life circumstances can change your opinions. But people don't really go from like understanding the science of climate change to thinking climate change is a hoax and nothing needs to be done about it. You know, like,
see, I think this is getting to, though, where I think politics are going to cleave, which is that the fights of the future are not, is climate change real or not? It's, you have a Green New Deal, which somehow leaves out nuclear power for reasons that have yet to be explained to me by anybody at the Sunrise Movement, aside from a very strange cultural grievance. So I think that the future would be like, if you have a right-wing politician or somebody, it'd be like somebody who's a pro-nuclear or like just all in on nuclear versus some, you know, wind, solar, you know, union jobs that miraculously appear from nowhere. The kind of people that I really like to think about are, and a lot of these people are my viewers, so I kind of feel the way to represent them. They feel very politically homeless, especially some of the Latinos who will reach out to me. They're like, look, I'm 35 and I voted for Trump. And I'll just be like, why? Like, what's going on? And they're like, I live in South Texas. I'm pro-life. I'm pro-Medicare for all. I believe in guns and I hate the media. And I voted for Trump because I hate the media. I mean, that just like doesn't track on politics, but actually, in my opinion, quite representative of what politics might look like 20 years from now. So just think about it a little bit from that perspective of let's extrapolate out and let's say the boomers, I mean, given life extension technology and all that, they're going to be around for a while. But let's say 20 and 30 years from now, what does the median center of politics look like? Is it necessarily progressive or conservative? Like, what? I think it will be distinctly millennial in the way that I'm describing that Latino voter. This is just one guy who reached out to me, but I talk about him all the time. Just think about it from that perspective.
Yeah. So I think that you hit the nail right on the head there. Yeah. And in fact, one of the things that you said earlier, I think is also a really great example of this, which is that I am not arguing that the boomers will age out of the electorate and then this kumbaya millennial moment will happen where all of these millennials agree on everything and they'll all hold hands and build a better America. That's not my argument. My argument is that the fights of the future will replace the fights of the past.
Yeah.
So, okay. When you said earlier that we're not arguing about gay marriage anymore, you're right. We're not. It's over. Like, you know, that the debate about who what is a legally married couple in the United States was something that consumed the right wing in this country.
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah.
For years, and now,
don't forget, like, you know, President Obama, and I doubt he actually, but in 2008 was not pro gay marriage. So this wasn't just a right wing thing. Yeah. The whole center of that issue was far more to the right in both parties.
Exactly. So Marshall, I think you're totally right. So like, that's an example of an issue that like people are not going to be fighting about in 2030. That doesn't mean that they won't be continuing to be fighting about, for example, trans access to bathrooms
that's going to be here for,
you know, other LGBTQ issues. I'm not, again, trying to argue that like we're entering some kind of like post-conflict paradise. I'm just saying that there are fights that were specific to a particular moment in American history that were done fighting. Like, for example, the fight about, like, you know, some of the sort of like 1990s conservative family movement about, like, should women like work outside the home and is it good for the kids? Like, that's sort of over. You know, even Republicans are not like arguing for that anymore. I think race is another place where, like, the old fights have been replaced with new fights. I mean, the fact that our conversation about racial justice now is much more focused on police abuses and what to do about that, and, you know, and what is the right way to make policing and the criminal justice system fair to Black Americans, is very different than the conversation that was being had around race and policing in the 1980s. Like, it's a new fight has replaced the old fight. And obviously there are some consistencies, and obviously there are places where we're arguing about some of the same things, but I think the parameters of the debate have changed.
You know, and this is so interesting because, Charlotte, I really appreciate the way you're describing this, because I can hear what you're saying, and I totally get the context that you're describing, but I could also seeing it lead to a lot of really poor conceptualizations of politics and how you actually win and succeed. So I could hear what you're saying and say, hey, look, the conversation on racial justice is totally different. America, in certain ways, can be majority-minority in the 2050s and 2060s, so as a young Republican, I should do this, this, and that. And that very much is the spirit of 2015, 2016 that I think you really eloquently described earlier. However, I think when you take those positions, I don't think they are that useful, because rarely, if ever, do they actually inform how even young people are thinking about these very direct issues. So, for example, California, the definition of a blue progressive state, is a state that shut down affirmative action. Yeah. Because you can entirely totally say, true. Hey, look, George Floyd was murdered. That was horrible. That was a crime. BLM. I see a lot of these people, frankly, that I went to college with. So people who are generically center left, but just aren't that political. But that doesn't mean they're going to support affirmative action policies. That definitely doesn't mean they're going to support reparations policies. And I get really frustrated when folks on both sides of the aisle who aren't political, who aren't politicians, but are actually activists, use this narrative to try to impose their specific policies, prescriptions on that thing. So how should we just think about, and Sagar, you pick up after she answers this, how should we just think about where does an acknowledgement that the conversation is changing, where does that stop? And we then recognize that, by the way, conservative Republicans are not going to be supporting reparations. Because I think that's what at least Stefanik and them ran into. I think they ran into, they made a mistake of assuming that, yeah, it's true. Look, they support and believe in climate change, but that's not useful. That's not how they're going to get elected. I think if you're a voter who actually cares about climate change, you're a Democrat. Sorry, I think the way that most center right people who I know approach climate change, they're like, yeah, it's real, yeah, no worries, duh. But like, I don't vote on that. So how do you just think about that dynamic? Because I see it's where so many politicians or aspirant politicians fail.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think frankly, one of the big problems I think in our political system right now, and I think this is especially true on the left, is sort of an over-reliance on activist narratives. You know, there are people who people who care deeply about some of these issues who are not, for whom they're not their main voting issue, right? You know, and that human beings are much more complicated and much more practical than and frankly, American voters are much more complicated and much more practical than oftentimes these activist narratives make them seem. I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons why you've seen the Republican Party and conservatives in general lean really hard into culture as, frankly, a really powerful political tool for them. I mean, the Republicans did not have a policy platform in 2016. It famously did not exist.
No, 2020, where they just copied and pasted.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'm so sorry. I just had a brain fart. You're right. It was 20. They did have one in 2016. Yeah. They did not have one in 2020. And yet they won.
Yeah, a lot of votes.
70
yeah.
million votes. You know,
more votes than 2016.
Yeah, that's 10 million more. Yeah.
Right. And so what that says to me is that there are millions and millions of voters in this country who are not making their decisions about how to vote based on like, well, I, you know, this is my issue is climate change. And this is the candidate with the best climate change plan. Therefore, I will vote for this candidate. Like that is a sort of like automaton robot voter who doesn't exist. Instead, there is a deep, there are many voters in this country that carry deep cultural attitudes and which often are tinged with deep cultural resentments, which frankly, Fox News almost exists to stoke that kind of cultural fervor that can create a political movement without any real policies.
Yeah, look, this is zero disagreement. That's why it's funny. Every time I see some of these progressives that are like, but you know, 80% support Medicare for all. I'm like, okay, well, the fight's going to be whether you support Medicare for all for illegal immigrants or not, or for abortion or not. And guess what? You're not going to want to see the numbers on that because literally none of them agree with you. Same thing.
I think you're totally right on that. And sorry, not to interrupt you.
But please. Yeah.
Those are two, you know, I do think that in projecting into the future, particularly for progressives, there are some areas where these narratives begin to collide with each other in ways that are very uncomfortable. Like
they never talk about it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've seen this time and time again. Or they'll say like, well, everybody should support canceling student debt. I'm like, okay, well, what about the 50% of people who are young who didn't go to college? And it very clearly becomes cultural. I already saw this happen, which is that Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley are talking about student debt. Do you know one of their solutions is to tax endowments, college endowments, and remove debt? I mean, that's an attack on the academy, which, cool, you know, like I'm not against it. But given that the emerging Democratic coalition is suburban whites who went to college, especially who went to good colleges, they're going to see that as a direct attack on
I mean,
them.
It is a direct attack.
No, but I'm
to the
like,
culture point.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that is like everything is going to get weaponized along lines where they'll be like, yeah, student debt is a problem, but screw the universities. Whereas, you know, the Democrats will put something where we'll be like, student debt is a real problem, so we'll just wipe it out. And it, you know, effectively, in my opinion, in-kind donation to like some of the already upwardly mobile people in this country. And I think student debt is abhorrent and is one of the chief problems, which is keeping people from being able to get married or not. But that's actually another thing, which is that I've seen all kinds of fights around UBI and cash assistance. So you might see, actually, this is a good example right now. The Republicans, Josh Hawley and them, put forward plans around means-tested cash assistance to families. We're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. And the fight in Washington was around not cash assistance, which is the old school conservative fight, probably where it would have been, but around, well, should we have a means test or not? Like, should single parents who don't work be able to get cash assistance or not? Which in a weird way is like 1990s level politics that are all coming back. So I just see everything begin to cleave a ride around the cultural line where America is still very divided, including amongst the millennial generation.
But I think that you, first of all, I think you made a lot of really good points there, but I think in some ways we're saying versions of the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that Josh Hawley has a plan for student debt means that this generation has changed the political priorities in this country. I mean, people were not talking about student debt as a major issue, a major bipartisan issue 20 years ago. It was not something that an up and coming Republican senator would be like, here's my plan for this big problem. So again, like we're talking about a realignment around a new set of problems.
Yes.
That are defined by the millennial experience. Millennials are the generation, and I guess Gen Z also, who are the ones carrying all this debt, right? Millennials and Gen Z are the ones who are going to be, you know, handling climate change. These are the most racially diverse generations in history. It's not a coincidence that race is very much at the center of our political conversation right now. So what I'm saying is, again, like, I never, you know, I think it's a misreading of my book. And I'm not saying that either of you did this.
Yeah, yeah.
To assume that I'm saying that, like, we're going to have like a post-conflict millennial political future, you know?
Good.
Because
that's all I just want to underscore for people. Because we hear it so much. It's such a once these boomers are gone, we're all going to agree. I'm like, we're really not.
We will definitely not agree. But I guess the way I would put it is, some problems will be behind us. New ones will take their place.
Yeah.
Probably having to do with technology. But essentially what we're talking about is a replacing one set of urgent priorities at the center of American political life with a new set of urgent priorities. And some of them will be the same. Like, taxation is always going to be like a thing that's on, you know, how much should the richest be taxed? How much should the middle class be taxed? That's never like aging out of the conversation. But, you know, there are things that we will be arguing about in 2030 that did not exist in 2008. And there are things that we were arguing about in 2000 that will be like totally under the water under the bridge. And that's, I think, part of the argument about generational change, is that a healthy political society has to evolve that way. You can't have the literal same people in charge who were in charge in 1994 making policy in 2024. Like, it just,
no,
because the world changes, the problems changes, the perspectives change, it doesn't make sense.
I have the role here of being the Joe Biden stan on the podcast. I sort of stepped into it. What if that's just not true? What if actually growing up in a world dominated by the internet, where politics is polarized, where you have all these different dynamics, is actually terrible for being a political leader? I would frankly much rather have Joe Biden in charge of the country than Madison Cawthorn. I think this, and once again, for everyone who always writes in and is angry when I do this Biden shtick, let's treat just Joe Biden, let's focus on December Joe Biden, when there are options open before he's actually become president. I think one could argue that having a president who might not be up and up with the Facebook and Twitter and all those things actually sounds kind of healthy. It actually probably is, like, and you could debate whether Joe Manchin's like a good, whether Joe Manchin is a good faith actor or not, but having politicians who at least have the ability to ask the question, hey, how do we govern in a country that's 50-50? So having Democrats who remember, wow, in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan bowled us over time after time after time. And actually, even though we controlled the Senate and the House, we had to do a balancing act. So there was a skill set. What I'm concerned about is, it's entirely possible that given the culture warification of politics, we could have a very performative online generation of politicians who actually may know how to use Twitter, but have no actual skill sets to actually behave in politics. So how do you just think about that?
So, by the way, I think you're totally right about Joe Biden. And it's something I think about a lot, because I wrote a book about generational change, about young leaders. Joe Biden was not the person I had in mind.
The exact opposite.
I say this all the time. One of the first monologues I ever did before I got really big was about why Joe Biden will never be president. So here we are.
Listen, you know, I feel like it's important in this industry to admit when you're wrong. And I did not predict that Joe Biden would be the nominee. And listen, I also agree with you that there was a series of events. I would say, starting when Trump got COVID up until inauguration day. So we're talking about really like 4 months.
It's like 3 months. Yeah, four months.
Yeah, like 3 or 4 months, where it was an absolute high wire act of political precision, of having exactly the right reaction to a series of like dozens of highly unusual events, from the president getting COVID to, you know, an election that was being sort of contested in the courts, to like not having results from certain states, to the insurrection, where I think Joe Biden, to your point, because of his decades of experience, performed like a Simone Biles level, absolutely pitch perfect response to each of those events, which is why we, sitting here in June of 2021, are in a, you know, relatively stable democracy. Like, if
and not to interrupt, because I want to put a specific point on this. Everything we're describing is politics. So this isn't, we're not debating Medicare for All here. We're not debating border security. We're saying, as a politician, he made, and the people who he chose around have made, a series of political decisions. I just want to really like double click on that, because that's the key thing.
Yes, I think you're totally right about that. Because again, we're not talking about like, oh, he changed his like healthcare plan or whatever. We're talking about like when Trump called the election a fraud, like here was his response that both diffused the situation. And like, you know, he just, that could have turned into a genuine like clusterfuck. And I think because Joe Biden had the decades of experience that he has, it, like, I'm not so sure that Pete Buttigieg would have landed each of those moments in the way that Joe Biden did. Like, I literally think about Simone Biles doing those flips, and then at the end, she's like, you know, like,
no, you're right. There's no way that he would have done it. No. Same with Kamala, all of them. They would have leaned hard into the fight, and Biden was just like,
or been influenced by Twitter too much.
Right. And Biden would have been like, yeah, he's saying whatever he wants. I'm just going to pick my cabinet. And you know, January 20th could come soon enough. There's no way.
Right.
It's fascinating, though. Let's fit in another generation, though, that you discussed, Gen Z. Where does Gen Z fit into all of this? Here in Washington, in more right-wing circles, there's like a joke that the Gen Z will be the one that save us all because they're way more radical, largely from like gamer chat and all of that. I think that's largely a meme and mostly a very online phenomenon. But what are their politics? You know, I don't actually know. This is the very first time that they actually voted. What do Gen Z politicians look like? I think Madison, is he the very first one, Marshall, or does he technically qualify? I'm not sure.
He's cuspy. He's like one of those people where like, he's sort of like either the last millennial or the first Gen Z, but he's cuspy.
Let's rule him out then. Let's say that the first true Gen Z politician has not yet come. What will they look like?
So it's interesting. I get this question a lot, and truly I am always reluctant to give a definitive answer because I just don't think we know yet. The reason that I was able to write the book that I could write is because by the time I was writing it in 2018, 2019, enough time had elapsed from some of these events, like, you know, 9/11, the financial crisis, Obama's election, that there was real like polling and data to suggest how these young people reacted to those events. Like, we know that 9/11 and the subsequent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan led young people away from this idea of, you know, America as the world's cop. Like, we know that the reaction was like, hey, these wars really suck. Like, let's not do this anymore. we know that the reaction to the financial crisis among young people was like, oh, wow, like, we're getting totally screwed by this financial system. Like, we need, you know, we need a realignment of how government regulates the economy and also how money works in politics. I mean, like, that's the basis of the Bernie Sanders.
Is that, but this is where it's so interesting to me, because we're doing a complicated dance here where we're describing progressives and apolitical people and conservatives and center right people. I just don't perceive there being a large number of just like generically conservative young people who are all about financial regulation. Maybe you see, in a weird way, the GameStop phenomenon back in January was kind of right wing in a weird, like, libertarian, very online way, very sort of Joe Rogan-y politics way, very Barstool Sports like. But I guess I'm always skeptical. You know, I, when we put it this way, I remember I grew up on Time Magazine. So I remember just the big cover photos after the financial crisis were talking about like resets and things being different. And then the Tea Party came and then all these things just sort of happened. So how do we just think about big narratives, especially for you as an author? Just how do you just think of narratives? Because I think it's so hard to look at those narratives and conclude. I mean, how many narratives did we see at the start of COVID of, oh, everything's different, everything's changing, and handshakes are a thing of the 20th century? And I'm in New York, you're in New York. It's obviously many, like hundreds of thousands of people died, millions throughout the world. I'm not meaning to demean that, but just from a pure lived experience sense, there are a lot of early books that were just sort of like typed out by September 2020 that look ridiculous right now. So just, I'd love for you to respond to that.
Totally. So, I mean, and what you just said is exactly the reason why I'm always reluctant to be like, this will be Gen Z's politics. Because again, I think it's too early to tell. But to your point about the financial crisis, like we do know that younger people have less wealth than their parents did at their age. We do know that they're not buying homes. We do know that they have significantly more student debt. We do know that they are just in a much more precarious financial and professional and economic situation than their parents were at their age. And so again, like it's always important with these narratives to acknowledge that like that does not apply to every single person under the right. age of 40. But when you have these, you know, several major trends. Of course, there are still people who believe in sort of like a 1980s era laissez-faire conservatism and are not for more financial regulation. But you also, like, I don't think it's a stretch to say that this generation has had a financial experience that has led them to be a little bit more skeptical about like the role of big money in politics, the role of big corporations in our economy. And that's why, and again, that's not to say like 90% of them support like this bill to do this, but that's, you know, that's why even on the right, there are not, you know, the dominant. And please push back if you think I'm wrong about this. I know you guys will, but I'm seeing even on the right, the dominant narrative is the wrong word. I want to say stance is not like, yeah, we love big business, like ExxonMobil, rock.
Yeah, no, you're correct.
This is great for the economy.
It's like, mostly we hate libs. Yeah, they're like, yeah, we hate
that's
libs.
That's not what's motivating young conservatives. Right. Like this, like, oh, like big, you know, banks are awesome. Like, like you know, no. Yeah. They might not be motivated by the other side either. But if you were to go around to young conservatives in 1988 or 1985, you know, you would be hearing a very different attitude about sort of our financial institution. You'd probably just be hearing more about the economy than you do from young conservatives right now, who are often more motivated by cultural issues.
Quick reference for the Gen Zers among us, Alex P. Keaton, look him up. He is a character, doesn't make any sense in today's context. It doesn't make so for context. He's a, what was the show? What show was that in the '80s with, cause this is where,
what is it?
Alex B. Keaton from,
Family Ties.
Here yeah. Family Ties. So this is how Michael J. Fox became famous. Now I'm adding my dated reference on TBT. Dated reference. So Michael J. Fox's character was this like young Milton Friedman carrying young conservative who's pushing back on his hippie parents and talking about how much he loved the free market. If they were to cast that character today, he would be much more Barstool Sports. He'd be much more own the libs. Like that's what his whole thing would be. He wouldn't, Charlotte, that's such a good way of putting it. He would not talk about the market when that was the character's whole thing on Family Ties.
Totally. I mean, like, and I would say that, you know, this is, again, I feel like this is maybe a good place to put this. Like, one of the things that I think, you know, frankly, one of the problems that young conservatives have right now is that there are not a lot of issues that people are like, I care, you know, I'm a young person who cares a lot about this issue, and that's why I'm a Republican. The Democrats actually do have a lot of issues where it's like you said earlier, if you're a young person who cares a lot about climate, you're a Democrat. If you're a young person who cares a lot about racial injustice, you're a Democrat. If you're a young person who cares a lot about LGBTQ rights, you're very likely to be a Democrat. One of the only issues that Republicans have working in their favor is this issue of free speech and, you know, what some people call cancel culture. Which I agree with, or I forgot who alluded to this earlier, but, you know, in talking about, again, a realignment of our politics, I think that that is an issue that's emerging. That's very like tricky to think about because it's a cultural issue. It's not actually like a political issue. And like all the bills that are like this weird stuff about like critical race theory and like that always feels weird because this is not, I am not necessarily convinced that this is something that can be legislated or not.
It's an affect is kind of how I would describe it.
Yeah, it's an affect. But I do think that many of the people who now are like really excited to be young conservatives, it's because it's a reaction to like the over-sanctimonious left. It's a reaction.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
It's a reaction to people like judging them and like scolding them for saying something that they shouldn't have said.
No, I've said before, I think that the best piece post-Trump on the American right was by Matthew Walther, and it's called Rise of the Barstool Conservatives. And whomever comes next within the right, and especially people on the right who could actually win a popular vote election, going to be a long time, it is going to be somebody like Dave Portnoy. And Dave Portnoy doesn't give a shit about social issues in the way that we're talking about. But he hates the media. He hates political correctness. He likes talking in like a generally more crass way. And he's a right-wing icon. And if you talk to him, he's even said, it's a hilarious, people should go watch his interview with Ben Shapiro, because Ben is like, well, do you agree on gay marriage? And he's like, no, like, I don't care. And so he's like, I literally don't care. I don't think about it. Gay people can do whatever they want. His opposition to the dominant culture has much more to do exactly what we're talking about with political correctness and social mores and trying to tell him what type of jokes he cannot say than it does have to do with any sort of policy. So for me, it all just comes down to affect. And I guess that kind of leads me to my last question for you, which is that are the politicians, that millennial politicians that we're stuck with, is that what it's going to look like? Or are things just so toxic that there's a bunch of people waiting in the wings? As in, look, let's be honest, like Madison is basically a young boomer. I think that Pete is also like pretty boomery. I really am hard pressed to find a millennial politician who doesn't generally represent the wants and needs of like their actual party base, as in which are mostly older Americans. Like, is there a new crop coming, or is this just generally how it's going to look?
So I want to respond to one thing you said earlier, and I have an answer to this, but another thing to remember here is that, and this is like the second chapter of the book, which is that like, the reason that you have this kind of reaction to political correctness is also because this generation has really fully embraced the idea that there are things that you shouldn't say, ideas you shouldn't have. And what's really interesting is that the reason they've embraced that, I think, is because they were raised that way. I mean, boomer parents were the first like super parents, like the first helicopter parents, like all of these conversations that now seem really normal, like, oh, like, is that an appropriate movie for a 5-year-old kid? Or like, ooh, like that was an inappropriate joke. Like, that's a bad word. Don't say that. You know, like all of this idea that, you know, oh, like, ooh, girls shouldn't play with Barbies because they might reinforce bad body image. Like, those are all things that were invented in the 80s and 90s, like right when millennials were little kids. So this was a boomer parenting really intensified in this way that created this generation of kids that were, you know, and people were kind of writing about it at the time too, like, oh, these kids are going to be so sheltered. They're going to be so this, they're going to be so that. But like, this cultural schism has been brewing literally since childhood, because baby boomer parents were like way more intense about sort of crafting their children's world and protecting them from ideas or words or images that, you know, might be harmful to them. Like the idea of like, oh, this movie has violence in it, like my kids can't see it. Mm-hmm. That was not something that parents in the 1960s gave a shit about at all.
Right.
So I think that's like a, sort of one of the important things to remember here is that some of this really can be traced back to literal childhood in the 80s and 90s, which was different than childhood in the 50s and 60s when our parents were growing up. But to your point about like whether this is the crop, I definitely don't think so. I mean, like this, my book was meant to be a snapshot of like the rookie teen, like the first vanguard of,
that's such a good way of putting it,
of yeah. this generation of leaders. There are going to be new people who are elected in 2022, in 2024, in 2026. Like this is just the beginning, like the first wave on D-Day almost. And what I was trying to do here is really kind of point out all the ways that our political system is being realigned around these millennial priorities. And new millennials who do fit into this framework in some ways, and of course will buck this framework in other ways because they're humans and humans are inconsistent and unique in all of their beautiful uniqueness. But you know, I'm sure some of them will lose. Some of them already have lost. I'm sure some of them will retire and decide politics isn't for them. I'm pretty sure Pete Buttigieg is going to be around for a really long time. but in general, like I expect that we will see, you know, a whole generation of these millennial leaders who, again, are putting millennial concerns at the center of the political conversation. And that, again, doesn't mean that they agree on everything. They don't agree on the solutions, but at least they're agreeing on what the problems are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And two things as we finish up here. So one, just a response. I love your defining free speech as the affirmative issue that puts a lot of people who are millennial or Gen Z in the conservative camp, because A, I think that's true, but B, it also causes and demonstrates the problem facing ambitious conservative politicians, because that issue doesn't inform your perspective on any other issue. So if you are a progressive Democrat, your position on the Green New Deal actually should inform your position on Medicare for All, because like the underlying idea here is, hey, like technocracy works. Hey, like the government, the federal government should have these big goals, this and that. This goes all the way down the line. It could really help you get a tool set to address issues. But free speech, that has nothing to do with welfare policy. That has nothing to do with COVID relief. It basically leaves you with nothing. So looking at this looking at the first wave of millennial politicians on the right, I think the problem they ran into is that they were not capable of putting together a comprehensive framework that could actually give them, I think, the ability to articulate this in a way that's useful. So let me just ask you this. Putting together everything you said, the thesis I've basically come up with is the problem facing any ambitious politician on both sides of the aisle, because we get a lot of questions from the audience, from people who want to run for office. I would say if you are a Republican, your problem is the things you need to do in the short term are very backwards looking. So the thing you need to do to get elected in that primary, if you're Madison Cawthorn, are definitely leaning into the past in many ways. And that in many ways are going to limit your future in the 2030s, 2040s, 2050s. That is the danger if you're a Republican. If you're a Democrat, though, I feel as if the danger is you're going to lean too far into a projection of what the future is going to look like. I had an experience where I was talking, I'm Jewish, and I was doing a Zoom event at my synagogue, and I was talking to this kid who was in law school, and he was just talking about how he's really conflicted about Derek Chauvin. Sagrinova's story about Derek Chauvin, you know, going to jail. He's like, man, I'm so conflicted because, you know, we're all prison abolitionists. We're millennials, so I think he murdered him. But I'm like, dude, get out of DC, man. Like, that is not how most people think of. So I think that is just the prime example of someone like leaning too far into the social justice generation narrative. So is there anything you would add to like my framework of the dangers facing both sides?
I think you're onto something. And I think that you're right about where each side is going to run into problems. But ultimately, I think that they're also sort of running into the same problem, which is, again, this is a generation, which one thing we haven't talked about here is technology, which is the thread that runs through all of this, because this is a generation where every thought, every position, every argument they've ever had is very likely to be documented someplace. And it's a generation that is very comfortable, even enthusiastic about digging up stuff about other people and holding it against them. You know, oh, you were, you know, like, look at even the debate around policing in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder. Like, you know, there were like long time, very established, very credible Black Lives Matter activists who were being attacked because during Ferguson, they had supported, you know, police reform instead of police abolition. You know, like, and so I think that kind of like anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of public opinion is something that cuts against both sides, because I think for people on the left, it's going to mean that, you know, they're 2019 position on immigration is going to be held against them in a 2025 debate about immigration. And for people on the right, it's going to be, maybe the arguments and tweets and speeches that they make around free speech when they're running for Congress in North Carolina aren't going to age so well when they're running for Senate, or if they're running for governor, or if they're running for president, and they need to appeal to a broader, more moderate base.
I think that's really well said. Charlotte, it's been a great conversation. Really appreciate it. People can go ahead and buy your book at our bookshop. All the link, everything will be in the show notes. Is there anything else that you want to direct people towards?
No, I'm please buy the book. It's called The Ones We've Been Waiting For. It's been up to, the earlier version of it was written, in 2019, but the updated paperback is out now, and there's some new stuff in there. So I encourage all of you to buy it.
Awesome. Thanks, Charlotte.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hope you all enjoyed the episode. As per usual, we release these on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so there's plenty more to listen to where that came from. We have something really special coming down the line next week, so you'll all be very excited. Be sure to check the Breaking Points YouTube channel, and of course, check out my On Deck podcast episode with Sagar. Lots of great stuff, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting this podcast. See you next time.